favorite right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Cooperative presents Earth on the Air.
During the next 30 minutes, Earth on the Air's independent contributors explore commitment to place and community. A conversation with poet Gary Snyder about backyard politics. A visit with a master of the art of composting. Native American cultural self-hate, poetry, storytelling, music, and much more. First, we ask a group of Seattle women for their definition of community.
What does community mean to you?
It's about acceptance. It's about valuing diversity, valuing who we are as people, and that relationship that we build together.
Bringing people together and the whole idea of hospitality.
Getting out to help people that have been through different trials and tribulations, because I've been through a lot of things like that, so I'd like to help them.
It can happen around issues, it can happen through shared crisis, it can happen simply because people want to be joyful or celebrate with each other.
Our lives are so fast-paced and we don't have time for anybody else.
There is some longing for community, I think, in modern life. I think the key is to find where some of that exists already in a faster-paced urban area.
Opening up our lives and our homes and our communities to people that might be living right next door. Learning what a person's gifts, skills, capacities are, and being able to give them to their community and be a part of the community. What is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Who are the people in my neighborhood? How can I get to know them, and how can we kind of create a life that's more supportive of each other?
Last time you moved to a new neighborhood, how long did it take you to go out and meet your neighbors? Tom Stiles moved recently and decided to explore his new community first thing. Determined to find the soul of the neighborhood, he visited his local bank, shoe repair shop, park, hairstylist, topless bar, all-night grocery, talking to whoever would talk to him.
Crown Hill is on the west side of Seattle, looking out across the Puget Sound to the Olympic Mountains. I'd been wanting to find out what kind of neighborhood this is. What's the heart of the community here?
Is there anything, is there like some essential feature of Crown Hill that makes it what it is?
The New World Restaurant. It's got heavy rock and roll at night and lots of Chinese food in the daytime.
Most people, they move here when they're young, no? And they buy the house for a long time here, they're living here. And the children grow up, and the children go away.
We get a lot of elderly people in this area.
I don't know, it seems like more younger people moving into the area.
I see the late night people, the partiers, the people that go to the bars, people that go to the topless joints, you know.
But can you think of one thing in the neighborhood that I shouldn't miss?
I don't know, there's a cemetery back here that's centuries old, I guess.
What do you think, guys? The Crown Hill Cemetery? The guys should go to Crown Hill Cemetery.
Crown Hill Cemetery.
So here it is. Here's where they all come together. Anderson, Peterson, Uelvang, Gorman, Twig. Here's the whole Twig family. And it is here, really in the heart of the neighborhood, where people of all ages come together.
Today we find Value Chicken at his friendly neighborhood barbershop. Greetings, neighborhood barber. I'm Value Chicken, a chicken with no feathers, and I'm here for a haircut.
Hey, you dirty bird, get out of here. You want the health inspector to shut me down?
But I'm here to
What's a featherless chicken want a haircut for anyway?
Well, if I must be honest, I'm here to experience a piece of true Americana. I'm here to contribute to a sense of community by becoming a regular at my friendly neighborhood barber shop. So, how about that baseball game last night, huh?
Who do I call to get you out of here? The poultry inspector?
You're supposed to be a friendly neighborhood.
Get your poultry tail out of here.
But you're Americana.
You want me to call the colonel
you're
on you?
You're a piece of the neighborhood.
Get out of here.
And so Value Chicken is well on his way to becoming a neighborhood institution. Tune in next time for another episode of... Value Chicken.
Next, John McKnight's passion is the reinvigoration of our neighborhoods and communities. He works with the Center for Urban Affairs and Policy Research at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Kathy Bloom, who's an environmental organizer and regular Earth on the Air contributor, asked McKnight why communities seem to be having such a hard time these days.
One of the real problems of our time is that a lot of people see the world as being made up of themselves as an individual, or maybe with a couple or a few other people, families and like that. And then nothing else is in the world but big systems. If you live in that kind of a world, you are indeed not going to be very powerful. And you are not going to be, in a sense, a person with the power of a citizen. Right? I see in the university an awful lot of young people who strike me as being thought to be terribly advantaged, but I would say they are terribly dependent. They don't know how to do anything. They know how to respond to the demands of systems. They are good consumers. They are good clients. But they're not very good citizens. And not very creative. And not very powerful. The democratic answer to that is those people or individuals have to get themselves in association with others.
Next on Earth on the Air, writer John Molan tells this story about the community he grew up in.
Oh, God bless us and save us, Mary. You're not going to name him Johnny. That's what my grandmother said to my mother the day I was born. His great-uncle John was killed over a lousy job on the mines, and you'll be bringing bad luck on the baby. I came from Pittsville, Pennsylvania, a coal mining town where everyone was Catholic, half were Irish and half were Italian. There were a few other nationalities and religions, but they didn't have much say about how things went in the town. The Irish and Italians ran the show and fought each other every step of the way. They shared the same God and the same religion, but built separate churches, had separate cemeteries, and insisted on having priests of their own nationalities. It happened right down here on the tracks. My grandmother was still trying to convince my defiant mother, who was hell-bent on naming me John. Poor Johnny was walking home alone from the mines when a bunch of Italians jumped him and killed the poor soul. We knew it was the Italians because they was the ones looking for his job the next morning. Jobs were scarce, and the way to get one was to kill somebody who was already working and then show up at the mine the next day and hope they hired you, or one of your own. Both groups did it and both hated each other for it. Pittsville was divided. The Italians lived north of Market Street and west of the tracks all the way down to the river. The Irish lived everywhere else. Killings always took place on the streets or railroad tracks that bordered the neighborhoods and sometimes around the bars. By the time my grandmother was worrying about my name, the killings had long stopped. Some Irish and Italians were beginning to marry each other, which was almost always good for a fistfight, but the weddings were happening anyway. A few Italians joined our church and sent their kids to our school, which didn't set well with my grandmother.
I see the Carfagnos are sending their kids to St. Patrick's. I don't know why they don't build their own schools. Before you know it, they'll be taking over the whole town. You mark my words. My grandmother didn't need to worry about anyone taking over the whole town. To this day, the neighborhoods are separated by the same borders as always, and even with your eyes closed, you know when you're crossing one. You feel something. It's the blood of the murdered men reminding you how the neighborhoods got where they are.
Autumn's in the air in Chester County. Clouds are flaming crimson in a Pennsylvania sky. Sunset brings a chill, summer's fading from the hill. Brandywine September drifting by.
A lot of Americans, particularly young people, seem to have forgotten the value of commitment to a place. It's something that Susan Gleason has been struggling with lately. She attended a recent gathering of diverse individuals who wanted to better appreciate the region they all shared. They met on Whidbey Island, where the Strait of Georgia meets the Strait of Juan de Fuca at the north end of Puget Sound. Susan brought back these reflections.
There's nothing new going on here. This is ancient stuff. We sit in circles, play drums, a community bound by the region we live in. As individuals, we've been doing our best to live sustainably and protect our native environment. Some of us have been involved politically. Some of us are trying to live harmoniously on our little plots of land. It's pretty isolated work. But this weekend, on this forested island, we are united. We are the Ish River people. And we're not the only ones gathering like this. We're part of a bigger movement that some call bioregionalism.
Bioregionalism, in the most profound sense, is about knowing home and living in harmony with home. Everything about where you live so that you know how to live in harmony with it.
For bioregionalists like Peter, knowing home means getting to know the most basic elements of your local environment. Where your water comes from, how the climate works, which flora and fauna are native to the area, what happens with the change of seasons. But it's more. It's having a commitment to where you live, living there as if you really belonged. And commitment can be sort of scary. I know I like it here in Ish River Country. But for some reason, I have a hard time saying this is where I belong. Maybe it's like finding your life partner. When it's right, you just know it. My friend Marriott knew.
When I first came across the bioregional movement, it seemed like a coming home. And finally identifying my sense of why I belonged in Puget Sound, I very definitely immediately knew what the word meant, understood it. When people said watershed, I went, oh, yeah, right.
The sun goes down behind the Olympics.
Mary-Eyed even wrote a song about her home, a neighborhood in Seattle called Finney Ridge. Most of the time, I just live my busy city life, enjoying the view and complaining about the weather. It's a distant relationship I have with the land. But as we joined by the fire, singing about the salmon, I felt the wonder of the Ish River region. I thought about the eternal cycles of the salmon and the whole web of life they're connected to. And for at least a brief weekend, I felt myself connected to that web.
Describing a particular bioregion is not a cut-and-dried science, like drawing the boundaries of a county or a state. You might identify with your local watershed or drainage basin. Those are bioregions. But of course, there are also much larger natural regions. For example, here on the western side of North America, the bioregion known as Cascadia encompasses essentially all the northern lands that drain into the Pacific Ocean, from the Rockies on the east to Cape Mendocino, California on the south, up to Icy Bay in Alaska. Cascadia, in turn, can be divided into the dry side between the Rockies and the Cascades, and the wet side between the Cascades and the ocean. Within the wet side, Pacific Cascadia, are several smaller bioregions, all sharing similar climates and vegetation. The Puget Sound Strait of Georgia drainage basin is sometimes referred to as Ish River Country. One resident from the heart of Ish River Country is Lansing Scott. He edits Seattle's Community Catalyst newspaper. He also organizes and teaches other bioregionalists.
The idea of Ish River Country became popularized after a poet who lives up in Laconer named Robert Sun wrote a poem called Ish River Country. He took the name from the rivers, the Duwamish, Snohomish, Skykomish, Stillaguamish, Skokomish, Samish. Mish means the people.
Why don't you read the Mish meditation now?
Okay. This is something that I wrote, I guess, a couple of years ago in preparation for one of the Mish bioregional gatherings. We are the Mish of Ish River Country. We are a new tribe of dwellers in this land. We are a rainbow tribe. Original people, new people, people with roots going back a few generations. Red people, white people, black people, yellow people, brown people. We come together to protect and restore this place, to rebuild community, and to sow the seeds of a new culture, a culture of this place, in this place. We come together in community not only with the many colored people, but also with the flying people, the swimming people, the four-legged people, the plant people, and the past and future people. Because we know that as we shape our common destiny, we must consider all our relations. We are a diverse people. We are a rainbow tribe, a new tribe. We are the Mish of Ish River Country.
Lansing Scott's Mish meditation can be found in the book Home, a Bioregional Reader, published by New Society Publishers. Next on Earth on the Air, poet Gary Snyder, author of Backcountry, Riprap, and Cold Mountain, and Passage Through India. Snyder says more and more his energy is going into his immediate community. He says that's where he can be the most politically effective and directly responsible.
However you define your obligations to the world at large, if something happens in your backyard, it's your backyard. And that is a profound political and personal learning experience, not to distance yourself from the place that you're at. Now, if you don't know where you're at, or you don't have a place, then that's your first step. Having a vague network of friends out there who are of like mind is not the same as having a place. Think globally, act locally, in a sense is what I'm saying. Thinking globally really means know something about history. Don't run away from learning how economics works. Understand banking. No point in being pure. You're not going to save the world by not knowing anything about banking and economics, even though it may make you feel pure. Don't be afraid to work on more than one level simultaneously. Even while envisioning highly innovative structural reforms on the most speculative level, like doing away with the national state, like redrawing the boundaries of all the nations of the world into small bioregional nations, and so forth, simultaneously to be engaged in those political issues in your own backyard that will save lives. And often these things will save lives. Save the lives of spotted owls. Save the lives of kids. There is no inherent reason why you can't do both. You know, you get an angle on the political process by working hardball local politics that gives you insight on politics all the way up to the national level. Now you might say, but politics sucks. It does. But it is one of the several things, not the only thing, But it is one of the several things that does have a profound influence on our lives and on the lives of others. So it just happens to be one of the things, not all the stuff, but one of the things we have to do as part of being good citizens on green planet Earth.
Gary Snyder's most recent book is Practice of the Wild. Harold Belmont, or Flying Chief, is known by many Suquamish as that tribe's spiritual leader. As a substance abuse counselor, he tries to help other natives accept their anger.
We've had this 3 or 4 or 5 generations of being brainwashed that to be Indian was bad, to go to ceremonies was bad. In fact, it was against the law. And so that's where my anger is that I call it psychological rape. They've taken away our identity and even made us feel ashamed to be Indian. And so today our struggle is to make Indians understand it's okay to go back to that culture. It's okay to go back to that identity. I went to a Sundance one time in Rocky Boy, Montana, and there was a 90-year-old Cree grandmother, and she came to our camp because she knew we were visitors from the West. And she says, I want to welcome you here to my reservation. And I want you to know that when you go to the arbor, to the Sundance, that you won't see me there. And she showed me in her hand, she had some prayer beads. And she says, when I was a little girl like this, the Black Robes came to this reservation and they told my family that this Sundance was bad, it was no good, and it was outlawed on my reservation. And so I never grew up accepting or understanding the Sundance. I'm 90 years old today, and I got my beads, my prayer beads, and I go to Mass every Sunday. So when you go in that Sundance, you're not going to see me there. That angers me, and that outrages me, because the grandmother was telling us, look what they did to me. They took away my Sundance and replaced it with these beads. How dare you ask me what my rage is? How dare you? But it's something we can work through. She's working through it the best way she can. She worked through it by come telling us the story. And I think when you express your rage, that's the beginning of a healing process. What's happened to our native culture is that we have been taught to internalize our oppression. And so that when it's carried like that, it turns into something we like to call cultural self-hate. We haven't really learned how to trust. Just like I don't know you. Number one, I don't trust you. Number two, I don't like you. I may learn to trust you, and I may learn to like you. But just off of the top, anytime someone comes in my home with a tape recorder and a pencil and a piece of paper, you know, if you had any respect at all, we would have talked for 2 or 3, 4 or 5 hours, even before this tape recorder came out. So I don't have any more trust or like for you than I do any of them. And I'm talking about white guys. And not so much white guys, but a dominant society that has certain values. Because what we're finding out today, that many times the dominant society is not white by color, but it's white by value.
Finally on Earth on the Air, a master at the art of composting, working with Seattle's award-winning Master Composter Program, Diane Michael goes door-to-door and to fairs and trade shows, sharing with her neighbors what she loves best.
We Master Composters have a few things in common. We love playing in dirt. We like old, moldy bread heels and eggshells and apple cores and worms. The more the merrier.
They dig little tunnels and they set up their own little housekeeping, you know.
Are those earthworms or are they special worms?
They're special. They're special called worms. Red wrigglers. And they're redder than earthworms.
I thought they were sort of, yeah, bright.
There's a little bitty one.
Yeah.
Here's another
they're
one.
They're sort of two-tone, aren't they? And so they're specifically
like to eat garbage.
That's right.
It's their whole mission in life.
Master composters set up shop at trendy street fairs like this one to spread the gospel. Our message? Simple. Home composting, whether it's in a worm bin or a steaming pile by the garage, is the most economical way of recycling your yard and food waste. It constantly blows me away. It's so easy. It's so natural. No one has to collect it. No one has to sort it. No one has to clean it. No one has to burn it. No one has to landfill it. No one has to market it. It's recycling at its best. When you compost, you come full circle. You start with apple cores and potato peels, and you end up with juicy apple trees and homegrown potatoes. You start to see garbage not as garbage, but as a resource.
See, our soil where we live here is real clay-like and real hard, so it really doesn't support good plant growth. So you have to go out to Ernst and you got to buy, you know, all this expensive stuff. So hopefully, you know, we'll be able to at least recycle our own food instead of paying all that money for dirt.
There are many different ways of degrading last night's stale popcorn, but let's focus on my favorite, those red wigglers. A worm bin is a wooden box with a lid filled with some sort of bedding, sawdust, leaves, newspaper, and your kitchen scraps, and of course the worms. Worm bins are quick and efficient machines for pumping out rich, luscious compost destined to feed your green peppers. Because it's a self-contained box, worm bins don't smell or leak. And get this, you can even keep it in your apartment. I know, I was skeptical too. If you don't believe me, follow me as I dig through Howard Sten's worm bin. He's the director of the Master Composter program.
So now you're saying that worm bins don't smell. They
don't smell?
No, it smells good, actually. It really does. I smell citrus and I smell the sawdust, which smells really good. But yeah, I think a lot of people have conceptions that, you know, worm bins would smell or...
Well, a poorly managed worm bin can smell. If you put things in that don't break down easily, like cheese and meat, that can do it. If you overfeed it, if you don't have enough bedding in there and you put a lot of the gooey, fresh, green vegetable waste in there, it will just get wet and it will start to break down without air because the air can't get through the moisture and it will start to stink. This bin is recently rebedded, so it's totally full of sawdust. You don't really see much food waste. You can see that if you pull a little bit of the sawdust aside, there's lots of worms here.
Wow, tons of worms.
And then get down to the food waste down below, and which is hot right now.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of worms in there.
Yeah, well, let's talk about all this stuff we're looking at here. I see orange peels and raisins I see. I see this is a little dull pineapple thing
that'll be decomposed. Up here.
So you can see what an exciting life we master composters lead. I could go on and on, but Howard and I have to run. We're going to go do some troubleshooting on a citizen's backyard bin. It's not breaking down quite right. Well, we'll figure it out.
In here, there's a lot of dry kind of stuff there.
This is the most recent. This has been put on within the last couple of weeks.
It looks like some soil that's been put in. There's a lot of worms that are active in there.
Yeah, there certainly are.
There's lots of worms in this.
There's a little bit of steam in there. Oh, what is this plastic thing?
That's the show. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, it's your program, too. Find out how to get involved. Write Earth on the Air at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. That's Earth on the Air, Box 45883, Seattle, 98145. We'd be delighted to work with you. If you'd like a cassette copy of this show, call 1-800-767-1929. Mention that you want program number 5. We had additional help from Scott Bergen, Craig McDonald, Holly Chase, Ted Jessen, and Tom Stiles. Additional music was by David Hines, Michael Greiner, Blood on the Mandolin, Carol Ann Stockton, and Randy. Production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions and KCMU in Seattle, as well as KSER in Linwood, Washington. Partial funding was by the New Roadmap Foundation, Lisa Crosby, and Pacifica Program Service. For Earth on the Air, I'm Peter Maloff.